Okay. Okay, good evening to everybody. Good evening to everybody. It's my distinct privilege and honor on behalf of the entire shul to introduce Rabbi Breitowitz. Rabbi Breitowitz, of course, needs no introduction. Rabbi Breitowitz has left an indelible mark on the shul and on the broader Silver Spring community. I have Kar Satov, and I'll thank Rabbi Breitowitz personally for being a very, very significant help to me over the years. We're in contact regularly, and I thank you for your help. We are looking forward to your presentation, and the only thing that I could add is that Rabbi Breitowitz's lectures now have a new zing. Rabbi Breitowitz's Torah is coming from Eretz Yisrael, from Yerushalayim Eretz Kodesh, and of course, Avira Eretz Yisrael Machkim, the wisdom of Eretz Yisrael makes those who are wise even wiser. So, of course, it is a significant opportunity that we have this evening, of course, to hear about tonight's topic. So without further ado, I introduce Rabbi Breitowitz.
Thank you, Shalom Aleichem. It's certainly good to see everybody. People sometimes ask me how I enjoy my retirement. But thus this past week, on behalf of my employer, I was in Lakewood, Baltimore, Passaic, Upper West Side, many times, Long Island, Brooklyn, Chicago, Detroit, and Toronto. So that's kind of my retirement. But this speech, this talk, is the only talk, which is totally on my own. It's not for our Sameach, because after all of the traveling around, I wanted to come home. And although this is not the ultimate... And on Sunday, I'm going to the real home, but nevertheless, as long as I'm in the United States, this is indeed home, and it's always a wonderful feeling to come back. I noticed, I think I pointed out last time, that the clock is on the side. You know, I could have used that, because when the clock was directly in front of me, I always had a guilty conscience. It didn't stop me from the length of my journey. But it did mean I felt bad. Here I could totally ignore the clock, so actually I could have used that. I don't know, they didn't give me that opportunity. And of course, there's a famous rabbinic joke that when a rabbi leaves a shul or takes a leave of absence or vacation, and maybe kal vachomer if he retires or leaves, there are two things he's afraid of. One is the shul will collapse, and the other is they will do great. And that is a worry on both sides, but Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given me the second problem to worry about much rather than the first, and the Rav has certainly done a very, very outstanding job, and the Kehillah should continue to grow and to be matzliach in all ways. I know the shul banquet is coming up, and I very much had hoped that I would have been able to be at the shul banquet. Unfortunately, my wife, Sally, was supposed to come with me, and that would have allowed us to stay longer. She had a bit of a medical crisis, which thank God is now okay, but that would not allow her to travel. So as a result, I myself am cutting the trip a little short, and as a result, I'll be missing the banquet, but nevertheless, I'm certainly with all of you in spirit, and kind of want to give a mazel tov to the Nelkins, who are well... long overdue honorees and very, very well deserving of the honor. And I guess my other announcement is that I know that there have been many, many bereavements over the past few months. And once again, Acha Nochi Lutzara, certainly we still feel the tzaras that people of the Kehillah are going through, and Hashem should give all of them and all of us nechames and only to see smachot in the future. Because I will not be here on Yom Yerushalayim, I'll be in Yerushalayim on Yom Yerushalayim, Baruch Hashem, I thought, though, that it is coming up, and Yom Yerushalayim every year is a very special day. This year is even a bit more special because it is the 50th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, and it's something that one thinks about. Number one, it reminds you of how old you're getting. Because I remember the Six-Day War, and I won't tell you, and you know, I'm sure many of you remember it as well. And really, there are two little vignettes I just want to share with you just to start off. And that is, we still remember those words over the radio, because Israel itself was quite surprised. It was not part of its original military strategy to bother with the old city or the Temple Mount. You know, we wanted to repel the enemy and create security. But as matters unfolded, and it seemed that we would have an actual chance to reunite the with the old city and with the Harabayat, which had not been accessible to Jews since 1948, for those 19 years. There was a sense of wonderment. There was a sense of, can this actually be happening? People remember the radio announcement, the announcement over the radio. General Matagur was going through the gates and said, Har HaBayit B'yadenu, the Temple Mount is in our hands. There was such a miracle. Many people really, really felt that Mashiach was on the verge of coming, and, you know, who knows? As is often the case in Jewish history, there are moments of redemptive potential. There are moments of divine light. There are moments that are called Eis Ratzon, times of grace, which, if we would have risen to the occasion, perhaps could have turned into a messianic impulse. The birth of what is called the Baal Tshuva movement, whatever that means exactly, is basically dated from the Six-Day War. That this created a tremendous yearning to connect back to Torah and the like. To some degree, the Yom Kippur War set things back a little bit, because once again, we discovered that we are not as invincible as we thought we were. But the Six-Day War was indeed a tremendous, tremendous turning point in Jewish consciousness. They tell a famous story from that time that at the Temple Mount, shortly after it was regained and people were davening at the Kotel, which had not even been cleared yet. Basically, there was about a bunch of rubble and houses right up to the Kotel. So there was a soldier that had no religious background. He's what we call a chiloni, who was sobbing at the Kotel. And one of his colleagues asked him, one of his friends asked him, what are you crying about? You don't even know what this represents. And he pointed to the religious soldiers who were crying. And he said, I'm crying because I don't know what they're crying about. That's something that causes me to cry. Now, in truth, this is not only a matter of chiloni. The truth of the matter is, this is actually something that we have to ask ourselves exactly. You know, we don't fully understand, we don't fully appreciate what an absolute miracle it is that there is a state of Israel, that's Yom HaTzmaut already, that a Jew can go to Yerushalayim, a Jew can go to the Kotel. If you have the right halachic psak, you can go on the Harabayit, but again, as I say, that is both a political issue and a halachic issue. And the like, and what a miracle it is that we just take it for granted. We just take it for granted. We don't even recognize everything. Again, I'm talking to myself. We don't even recognize what a miracle it is that Moshe Rabbeinu prayed to be able to have a chance to come to Eretz Yisrael, even as an insect, as a bird. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not allow him to do so. And yet, every one of us, with the inconvenience, granted, a serious inconvenience of a 12-hour LL flight, whatever it is, and you know that, and you know, I'm not going to, you know, minimize the discomfort of that flight, but still, overall, it's a relatively minor inconvenience, and we can just get there. You know, I dare say, well, that's not my role to give any type of mitzvah, but I dare say that if our forefathers and our foremothers, who were yearning to come back to Eretz Yisrael, would see how easy it is just to come to Eretz Yisrael today, they would really wonder, what are people doing here at all? But again, I'm not here to make anybody feel guilty. If anything, I will tell you that one of the hard-earned wisdoms that an Oleh gets is that he becomes more reluctant to push Aliyah and others because there are indeed issues that one needs to consider. But nevertheless, every single day, we have to understand that in spite of our diminished spiritual state, in spite of the fact that we are not as holy as our ancestors, that the generations have gone down in holiness, and in the aftermath of the devastating destruction of the Holocaust, which we have no explanation for, Hashem in His kindness gave us the opportunity to return to Eretz Yisrael, and superimposed on that, to be reunited with Yerushalayim, and one has to appreciate it every single day. You know, the Mishnah says in Maseches Tainis that the happiest days of the year were Yom Kippur and the 15th of Av. And the Gemara asks, I understand why Yom Kippur is a happy day, it's the day of forgiveness, that's a tremendous thing. What is so great about the 15th of Av? The Gemara gives many, many reasons, but one reason it gives is really very pertinent to this topic. One reason that it gives is Hoshea ben Ela, who was the last king of the 10 tribes before Sanherib exiled, he removed the impediments, the barriers, that Yerevan ben Nevat, when Yerevan ben Nevat established the northern kingdom, he put guards and policemen like East Berlin, not allowing people to have access to the Beis HaMikdash. Hoshea ben Ela removed those impediments. And the tradition has it, it was on the 15th of Av, and that enabled access to the Beit HaMikdash, and that became a day of Simcha. Now the Gemara asks the obvious question, if he did such a wonderful thing, why was it that the 10 tribes were exiled precisely during his reign? And the Gemara's answer is, he removed the guards, but nobody went anyway. Meaning to say, until that point, everybody had an excuse, I can't go to the Beit HaMikdash. He removes the guards, nobody goes, so that's a bit of a kitrug, a bit of a prosecution in Shemayim. But nevertheless, what you see from the Mishnah is that when one is given an enhanced opportunity to be able to go to the Beis HaMikdash or the Har HaBayit, that itself is a source of great joy. That would be included in the great Simcha of the 15th of Av. The Rambam himself. The Rambam was born in Spain, and because of his various Islamic persecutions, they wandered, the Rambam's family wandered into different countries, Morocco. Eventually, the Rambam spent most of his years in Egypt. But for a short while, the Rambam actually lived in Eretz Yisrael with his father. And the Rambam records that he was zocheh to visit the Kotel Maravi, which at that time was only a small little pile of rocks coming up from the ground, because it had been a landfill and a garbage dump. And the Rambam writes that the day that he was zocheh to see the Kotel Maravi, the last remnants of at least the wall of the Har HaBayis, not the wall of the temple itself, but the wall of the Har HaBayis, he considered to be the happiest day of his life. And the rest of his life, he celebrated that day as a Yom Tov. Right? The Rambam records this, that this was a personal Yom Tov, the day that he was zocheh to be mispalel, to daven, at the last remaining wall, remnant of the Beis HaMikdash. So we do take things for granted. You know, there's a famous verse in Tehillim, from Tehillim, that we say between Elul and Sukkot, L'David Hashem Ori. And David HaMelech says, Achas sha'alti me'eis Hashem, osa avakesh. There is one thing I ask from Hashem. Shifti b'veis Hashem kol yimei chayai. Let me dwell or sit in the house of Hashem all the days of my life. Lachzos b'noam Hashem, to see the sweetness and the pleasantness of Hashem. Ulevaker b'heichalo, and to visit his sanctuary. So the Mefarshim point out there's a bit of a contradiction in that verse. Because on one hand he says, I want to be in the house of Hashem my whole life. And then he says, and I want to visit. Well, if you're there the whole time, you're not visiting. Is it shifti kol yimei chayai? Or is it levaker b'heichalai? And the answer that Hasidim say, a very famous Hasidish of Ort, that David HaMelech is mispalel, that he be surrounded by Kedusha all of his life, but it should always feel like a first-time visitor, that he should never take it for granted. Imagine a bar mitzvah boy who puts on tefillin. Such an exciting thing, right? Very, very exciting. Probably he's been looking forward to it for a year, maybe more than a year. And he finally gets on to put on tefillin, although the straps probably collapse when you first start putting on tefillin. You know, it's hard to keep them on your arm. And how exciting it is. But Nebuch, year after year after year after year, you know, when you're 35, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, kind of, all right, keep on going, Me'ev Yesrim, one is not necessarily excited about putting on tefillin. We take things for granted. We take things as habit. And David HaMelech is mispalel, that he should never lose the freshness, never lose the enthusiasm, never lose the excitement of his encounter with Kedusha. And this indeed is an occupational hazard for perhaps the Ola, because in fact this might be the one advantage that Chutz La'aretz people might have over Eretz Israel. Because you can have a yearning to come to Eretz Israel, and as a result, you may take it less for granted. Someone once asked Rav Huttner, what did he miss about living in Chutz La'aretz? And he said what he missed about living in Chutz La'aretz was the yearning to make Aliyah and to come to Eretz Yisrael, because he was already there. Right? Once he's already there, take it for granted. One complains about the bureaucracy, about the buses, about the garbage, about the strikes. There's plenty of things to complain about. But to take this tremendous gift for granted is really the greatest sin of being a kafui tov to the tremendous chesed that Hashem showed us again in the aftermath of the devastating Churban of World War II. Hashem gave us, I don't want to use the word compensation because that's a difficult philosophical issue. I don't want to get into it's one thing worth another thing. That's not for us to say. But at least Hashem showed us that even after devastation, He showed us His love, He showed us His care, He showed us His concern. He gave us gifts, and we have to appreciate these gifts. Now, in truth, there is a bit of a fundamental contradiction in Judaism. Judaism generally emphasizes the holiness of time over the holiness of space. The holiness of time, Shabbos, Yom Tov, etc. And in fact, we have a general idea that when Moshe Rabbeinu was standing in front of the burning bush, Hashem tells him, take off his shoes, because the place where he is standing is holy ground. And the Chafetz Chaim says, this is a message to every single person. Never think, I can only be holy if I'm there or in that particular place or that particular environment or that particular family or whatever it is. In whatever matzav a person finds themselves, they can and therefore must connect to Hashem. So in some ways, the very fact that Shavuos is coming up, the fact that the Torah was given outside of Eretz Yisrael, is to remind us that a connection to Hashem can exist everywhere. So on one hand, there is a bit of a de-emphasis on making a relationship to God contingent on a specific geographical space, because one needs to understand that God transcends space. At the same time, there are so many halachot which do indeed demarcate the idea of Kedusha. Eretz Yisrael is holier than other lands. Within Eretz Yisrael, we have Yerushalayim. Within Yerushalayim, we have the Har HaBayis, and we have many, many gradations within the Beis HaMikdash itself until you reach the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So, we kind of live in a paradox. On one hand, one can never use the absence of the Makom as an excuse not to grow in their relationship to Hashem. You must grow in your relationship to Hashem, whether you live in North Dakota, or Iowa, or Hong Kong, or Alaska. One cannot say, I'm not in the ideal environment, therefore I put my spiritual life on hold. That's a mistake, and that is a Yetzer Hara. But at the same time, the Torah does talk about the idea that there is a Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place that Hashem has chosen. And we know that Yerushalayim is in the deep yearning and consciousness of every Jew. David HaMelech's verse that we still to this very day recite at a chasna, as we put ashes on the head of a chasan. Imeshkecheich Yerushalayim tishkach yimini. If I forget Yerushalayim, may I forget the use of my right hand. Tidvak lashoni lechiki im lo eskerechi. May my tongue cleave to its palate if I don't remember you, Yerushalayim, Imlay Allah, as Yerushalayim, Al Rosh Simchasi. It's a little incongruous as that pasuk is recited and the chasan breaks the glass. People break out in tremendous singing. You know, perhaps there ought to be maybe a moment of silence or something to take in what that thought is. In the moment of your greatest joy, we remember that our joy cannot be complete if Yerushalayim has not been built up in the glory, the spiritual glory, of Mashiach and the Beis HaMikdash. And when a person dies, if they are not zocheh to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, they will be buried with the dirt of Yerushalayim in their kever, because that is a comfort even to that guf and that neshama, that it is connected to Eretz Israel. We daven towards Yerushalayim, towards the Kodesh HaKadoshim ultimately. That is the place where all our tefillos go. In fact, the way the Mefarshim describe it, tefillos don't go straight up. Tefillos go horizontally across the Atlantic and Mediterranean. And then, when they hit Yerushalayim, they then go up. That's indeed how the process of tefillah is described. The tefillahs go in that direction, and then they go up to Shemayim. That's the reason why we say that in the olden days, before there were cell phones, so when it was mincha time in Penn Station or Union Station, anywhere else, so you always had a bunch of religious people who were taking up all the phones in order to daven mincha, because there was no comfortable place to daven mincha. But they have to know, if you're calling from here, it is indeed a long-distance call. There is at least a local call. There even something like a minhag, which is brought down in halacha, that one should cover the knives before Birkas HaMazon. One should cover up knives. And one of the reasons that's given, in fact, is because there was a ma'aseh shehaya, that a pious person, when he recited the bracha, Uvenei Yerushalayim, may Hashem rebuild Jerusalem, was so overwhelmed with grief that he took the knife and he stabbed himself. And therefore it was said to be too dangerous, and that's why the knives are removed or covered up. Now you might say, well, that's not going to happen to me. I mean, I'm not going to do that, so let me leave the knife on the table. But you have to understand that sometimes halachas are designed to teach me how I should feel, even if I don't quite feel their meaning. Yeah, you should feel like you want to stab yourself, which isn't good. Therefore, take away the knife. I don't feel that way, but you should feel that way. And therefore, the minhag itself is reflective of the depth of the emotion that a person should have. Yerushalayim has many, many names. It has over 100 names. I think there are 105 designations of Yerushalayim in Nach. It is mentioned, it or its appellations are mentioned more than 600 times in Tanakh. For comparison purposes, you know, the number of times Jerusalem is mentioned in the Quran is exactly zero. So when we talk about the connection to the city, it's a fairly obvious point, except in the United Nations, which somehow doesn't get it, although I think Ambassador Haley may teach them something about that. So the yearning is very deep. L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. At the end of the wedding, at the end of the Seder, at the end of Yom Kippur. And even in Yerushalayim, we say, L'shana haba v'Yerushalayim, the ideal Yerushalayim. So the connection is very, very, very deep. And it's a connection that the more you think about it, and the more you realize what Yerushalayim is, and what it can be, then the deeper that connection grows on you. With all of the difficulties, with all of the politics, with all of the divisiveness, Yerushalayim is still Yerushalayim. You know, it is said that there are, every city in Eretz Yisrael is holy, all of Eretz Yisrael is holy, but there are four holy cities, four special holy cities in Yerushalayim. They are Yerushalayim, in Eretz Yisrael they are Yerushalayim, there's Hebron, there's Tveria, and there's Tzfat. These are said to be the four holiest cities in Eretz Yisrael. And the Mekubalim say that they correspond to the four elements which are the building blocks of creation. Yerushalayim is the city of fire. And Tveria is the city of water. It's on Yom Kineret. Tzfat is the city of air, wind. And Hebron is the city of dirt. Right, those four elements. And in many, many ways, this actually corresponds to the overall personality of the place. Yerushalayim is a city of fire. Now, fire has many components. There is the fire of Torah, the light of Torah, but then there's the fire of machlokas, divisiveness, polarization. Yerushalayim has many types of fire. Good fire, bad fire, but it's fiery. Everything in Yerushalayim is fiery. If there's a fender bender outside your window, you will see in the morning 50 people gathering together to discuss who is at fault. And I remember at some point, 50 people were gathering together discussing who was at fault, and somebody finally said, you know, why don't we just call the police to resolve it? And he said, no, 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 we have to argue this out first, and then we'll call the police. Right? So Yerushalayim is the city of Esh. Tiberia, on the Yam Kineret, a place where people go for recreation, for pleasure, for enjoyment. On one hand, Mayim is Torah, but Mayim is also pleasure, so Tiberia is a much more relaxed place. Tzfat, the city of Mekubalim, the city of mystics, is ethereal like the air. You don't have the fire of Yerushalayim, but it's very, very rarefied in terms of its atmosphere. Hebron, which of course Hebron is very, very difficult. There's much fighting in Hebron, although there's Kiryat Arba has many, many Jews. Hebron has a small group of courageous Jews who actually live in Hebron proper. But Hebron is the site of the graves, the kever, the kvarim of Maarat HaMachpelah, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, not Rachel, but Sarah, Rivka, Leah, and that is connected to dirt. But be it as it may, the fire of Yerushalayim is a fire that creates much heat, but it also creates much light. So what I want to do just briefly is I want to share with you 2 points about Yerushalayim from the Mor Nevuchim of the Rambam. Right? The Rambam of the Mor Nevuchim makes 2 very interesting points, and then I want to talk about the names of Yerushalayim and what we can learn from their names. The first point that the Rambam makes is that the Torah never, in the 5 books of Moses, in the Chamisha Chumsei Torah, the Torah never describes Yerushalayim. When it refers to where you'll build a Beis HaMikdash, where you will bring sacrifices, where you will bring Bikurim, it always uses a very general phrase, HaMakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place that God will choose. I'm not telling you where that place is. Now, the truth of the matter is, we know, of course, that the holiness of Yerushalayim and the Har HaBayis goes all the way back. That was the place that Adam HaRishon was created from. That is the place where Avram was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak. But still, there was a deliberate concealment in the Torah of the place that would be the place of the Holy Temple. And the Rambam gives 2 reasons why that is so. He said, if Hashem would have revealed the holy site of Yerushalayim, the enemies, the Yavusi, would have fought so ferociously to hold on to it that we would not have been able to get a military victory. The sacredness and the specialness of Yerushalayim had to be concealed from the world to enable the possibility, at least b'derech hateva, of a military conquest. That is what the Rambam says. And then the Rambam gives a 2nd reason, that had the Jewish people known which was the holy city, they would not have agreed to the tribal division. As you know, Yerushalayim is divided. The city of Yerushalayim is primarily in the chelik of Shevet Yehuda, and the Beis HaMikdash itself is actually divided between Yehuda and Binyamin. But had the rest of Klal Yisrael known that this would be in that allotment, they would not have agreed to that division. But Aliba DMS, Yerushalayim and the Har HaBayis is somewhat similar to the District of Columbia, Lahavdil, where although the land was taken or donated from Maryland and Virginia, it became a federal district. So too, although Yerushalayim is physically situated in the Chalik of Yehuda and Binyamin, in fact, the Gemara makes the point that we Paskin, Yerushalayim lo nischalko l'shvatim. Yerushalayim does not belong to any tribe. It belongs to the Jewish people as a whole. That may have some contemporary repercussions as well. So that's the first point the Rambam makes, that Hashem deliberately concealed in the Torah where the city of Yerushalayim, where the holy city is going to be, both to enable its conquest from enemies who would otherwise hold on to it with ferocity, and to allow the tribal division to proceed peacefully, which it wouldn't have had the other tribes known that Yehuda and Binyamin got what would later become the holiness of Yerushalayim. The 2nd point the Rambam makes is that at the end of Shmuel Beis, we discover David HaMelech purchasing the Temple Mount by collecting money from all of the tribes, from Aravna. Aravna is a non-Jew. Aravna, the Yavusi. And the Rambam raises the obvious question, why is there a need to purchase here? The Jewish people had conquered Jerusalem. Now, the conquest of Jerusalem, by the way, is not at all an easy story to pierce out from Tanakh, because apparently different parts of the city were conquered at different times. But the one thing we know is, the final conquest was, of course, in the days of David HaMelech. So, why does David HaMelech have to negotiate with the Yebusite about the Harabayas? It belongs to the Jewish people. We have sovereignty. So here the Rambam says a very fascinating idea. The Rambam says that although Am Yisrael owned the land, although Am Yisrael had sovereignty, but the place where God's Shekhinah rests cannot be produced through war or conquest. The same way, it's an extension, the same way that David HaMelech himself was not allowed to build the Beis HaMikdash because he was a man of war, although his wars were Milchemes Hashem and were totally justifiable. So too, the Rambam says, the very process of acquiring the Temple Mount, the Mokom HaShechina, cannot be through war, fighting. It must be through negotiation, purchase, consent, and shalom. Again, I don't want to fully draw the political implications of this, but the Rambam makes the point, this is why David HaMelech had to purchase the Temple Mount, as opposed to simply taking the Temple Mount the way the rest of Yerushalayim was taken. So these are two interesting points from the Mori Nevuchim of the Rambam. Now let's get back to the names of the city. As I mentioned, Yerushalayim has over 100 names. And the final name that is given, the name that it will have when Mashiach comes, and I'm not sure if this will replace Yerushalayim or just be another name, is Hashem Shama. This is the end of Yecheskel, which is a nevuah about the third Beis HaMikdash. Hashem Shama. Hashem is there. But the Gemara says, Al Tikri, do not read the words Hashem Shama, read the words Hashem Shema. God is its name. That somehow, in a way we don't understand, the city and the Ribono Shel Olam literally become one. That is the ultimate vision of Yecheskel. Not just Hashem Shama, Hashem Shema. An amazing thing. But I want to focus, of all of the 100 names, I want to focus on two names. The first, two groups. One is a group of three names and one is one name. Chazal tell us, with respect to the Temple Mount, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov each gave the Temple Mount a distinct name. Avram Avinu called the Temple Mount a mountain. That is where he was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak. Avram called it a mountain. Yitzchak called it a sodeh, a field. Vayetze Yitzchak vasuach basodeh. And Yaakov called it a bayis. When he had the dream of the ladder, he said, Ein zeh kiim beis Elokim. B'zeh shar shemayim. So Gemara in Pesachim says, there is har, there is sodeh, there is bias. And the Mefarshim say that this refers to three aspects of Kedusha that exists within Yerushalayim, within the Harabayas generally. And that is, a mountain is a place where you escape to avoid being dragged down by enemies that try to destroy you. In fact, historians have said that the ancient strategic importance of Jerusalem was precisely because it was hilly, and it was relatively easier to repel enemies who would be coming because you could throw stones at that, down at them, and the like. So one aspect of Kedusha spiritually is it is a place where you can go to escape the corrosiveness, the hedonism, the decadence, the secularism. You kind of get away from all that can take you away from Hashem. That is the Yerushalayim of the mountain. The ivory tower would be a more modern phrase. But that is not enough. Because the Bechina, the level of Ahar, is simply focusing on what you are negating and what you are excluding. It does not define what you are affirming and what you're trying to accomplish. So that is the second level of a field. A field is an area of productivity, of growth, of creation. It's not enough to be negative. It is not enough to denounce. One must learn how to build, how to create. One must know what they are affirming and not simply what they're making trace. That is the second level of Sadeh. The third level of Bayit is a home, not just a house, a home, Beis Yaakov. And that refers to the idea that whether in the context of the negation of the mountain or the affirmation of the field, it must be done within a construct of unity, togetherness, and family. And therefore that is that third level, that the Har and the Bayis have to exist within the framework. I'm sorry, the Har and the Sada have to exist within the framework of Bayis, right? So that's kind of the three names of the Har HaBayis. Now, the other name I want to talk about briefly is Yerushalayim itself, right? Yerushalayim, that's the name of the city. What does Yerushalayim mean? So the Medrash says a very fascinating thing. Yerushalayim is like Minneapolis, St. Paul. Meaning, there were really two different cities. The main part of the city was called Shalem. Remember, there's Malchi Tzedek, the king of Shalem. Shalem is Salem in English, right, where all those witches came from. So the original city was Shalem. At the time of the Akedah, when Avram was willing and Yitzchak was willing to be sacrificed on Mount Moriah, Har HaMoriah, Avram renamed Har HaMoriah, and he called it Hashem Yireh. God will look down and see the merits of the Jewish people who served him. Hashem Yireh. And what does the pasuk go on and say? Asher Yeyamar Hayom. It shall be said on that day, Bahar Hashem, in the mountain of God, Yei Ra'eh, he will be seen. Now just to translate that pasuk in a simple pshat, Hashem Yireh is Hashem sees us. Right now, Hashem sees us, but we don't see Hashem. We don't understand Hashem's ways. But Asher Yeyamar Hayom, but there will come a day, Mashiach Geula, where even the ways of God will be understood by us. Hashem Yireh. Hashem will be seen, meaning Hashem will be understood. Hayom is the remez, v'yom ahu yiyah, Hashem echad ishmorechad. But be it as it may, therefore, the city has two names. The regular city is called Sholem. The Temple Mount was renamed Yireh. So, Yireh, Sholem. The Aleph and the Hay of Yireh gets contracted into a Vav, because Aleph and Hay is Begematria Vav. So Yireh Shalem gets contracted to Yerushalayim. Not yet Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim. In fact, if you look in Tanakh, you will see that the vast, well, in the Chumash, of course, it doesn't mention Yerushalayim, but in the Nevi'im and in the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, where it mentions Yerushalayim, you will see it is always spelled, in fact, that's like the English, Jerusalem. The English actually corresponds to the way it's written. It is not written with that yud, Yerushalayim. It is written Yerushalem, because that's Yireh Shalem. So now we know how you went from Yireh and Shalem to Yerushalayim, but how do you get to Yerushalayim? Where do you get the last yud? So the Medrash says very beautifully that that's a plural. Raglayim, Yadayim, Einayim, Oznayim. Yerushalayim, two Jerusalems. Now, this is not East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, because we don't consider that two, but it refers to the idea that there's the earthly Jerusalem and there is the heavenly Jerusalem, and they're supposed to be in alignment, and that is Yerushalayim Shalmala has to be Mechuvan Kineged Yerushalayim Shalmata. So that's the significance of the name Yerushalayim. But to take this a little further, it's very, very interesting that Yireh itself, well, at least the letters of Yireh, Yud, Resh, Aleph, Hey, have a double meaning. In the Chumash, it's very clear that Hashem Yireh means God will see. He will see what Am Yisrael does and how they try to serve him, and he will consider the Akedah Yisuchus. But the Medrash says that the word Yireh, same letters, refers to fear of God, reverence of God, Yiras Hashem. So, the Medrash is kind of a pun on Hashem Yireh, interpreting Yireh as if it was Yiras Hashem. And then, what you now have is a paradox in the very name of Yerushalayim. And this is a paradox that is a live paradox, and an issue that we struggle with really every single day. And that is, Yireh, Yiras Hashem, is a wonderful thing. It's an important thing. Yireh, to fear the Almighty. Not in the sense, when I say fear, of course, I'm not referring in the sense of, you know, God's going to hurt me. But Yireh in the sense of awe, reverence. And as a person grows in Yiras Hashem, they become more passionate. They become more fervent, more enthusiastic. But there is often a hidden cost in that. As you become stronger and starker in your avodas Hashem, you often become less tolerant and less accepting of others who are not living up to the standards that you profess are emes. In the world as we find it, a growth of Yireh sometimes results in a reduction of shalom. And the other way around, people who are anshei shalom, I'm okay, you're okay. Judaism is a big tent. We open our walls to all sorts of ideas. That may come from a certain sense of not having moral clarity, not having clear values, not having Yiras Hashem, in which one defines one's morality by whatever is popular in the Western press at any given time, in which the New York Times might be the barometer of what I am Jewishly supposed to think. After all, Sulzberger family are Jews. So, in a sense, this city of Yerushalayim is supposed to be the city of Yireh and the city of Shalom. But how do you balance it? The short answer is that obviously the Torah is saying you have to have both. But in reality, one of the great, great struggles in Jerusalem, and this could be, where you put a stop sign, where you put a traffic light, because everything has religious implications, one way or the other, is how do we preserve and how do we grow in our Yiras Hashem, in our submission to God, in our serving Hashem, with passion, without compromise, and at the same time, have a tolerance and a respect and a compassion for the legitimacy of others who are living their lives based on what they think is right. In some ways, true monotheism, in a way, almost has to be intolerant. In a way, in fact, it's been pointed out that paganism can actually afford to be much more tolerant than monotheism. Paganism, I believe in 100 gods. All right, you have 101st, fine, bring him into. Monotheism claims an exclusivity of truth. So it's a real dilemma, right? How do I accommodate others? How do I accept others? But however you resolve that particular issue, the two names of Jerusalem hint, almost prophetically, that this is going to be the great struggle, the balancing of shalom and Yira. And I just want to point out that maybe there's no accident that Yom Yerushalayim, the unification of Yerushalayim, which is also the unification of Yira and Shalom, occurs during the period of Sfiras HaOmer. Because indeed, this is the challenge of Sfiras HaOmer itself. On one hand, Sfiras HaOmer is how we prepare ourselves for Matan Torah. It is the linkage between the holiday of freedom, which is Pesach, and the holiday of submission to Hashem, which is Shavuos. I've mentioned many times in Shul the thought of the poet Tagore, who describes a human soul like a violin string. There is beautiful music within that human soul. But if the string is totally loose, free, unencumbered, you won't get a sound out of it. Paradoxically, the beauty within that string is revealed only by submission. Tagore, of course, was not talking about Judaism or Torah. But that's exactly the point. The freedom of Pesach, as Chazal say, is the freedom represented by barley that was given to animals. But only when that freedom is linked to submission to Hashem does it become human. That's why the Korban of Shavuos are two loaves of wheat bread that are fit for human consumption. So on one hand, the avodah of Sfira is to be stronger and more intense in my avodah Hashem, to strengthen my davening and my mitzvos and my learning, and to understand that freedom without Torah is animal liberation and not human dignity. In other words, the avodah is to grow in Yira. At the same time, Sfira commemorates the death. This is a later development. This is not in the time of the Torah. But as a later development, this represents, we mourn the deaths of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. And people sometimes cynically ask the question, okay, 24,000 deaths is, of course, a tragedy. There's no doubt about that. But unfortunately, we've had a lot worse. 6 million, I mean, you know, so why are we making a point of 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva? Now, there are many answers. But the simplest answer is that if you are simply mourning a tragedy, we could pick worse tragedies to mourn. But the difference is that for this particular tragedy, Chazal gave us a very specific reason. You see, unlike the Holocaust, we can't give any definitive reason. It's not within our koach. But Chazal did say that the students of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show proper kavod, zelazah, proper honor, proper respect. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch writes that we can assume that the students of Rabbi Akiva were not grossly violating commandments of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. They weren't pushing each other out of line. They weren't insulting each other. They were keeping the Shulchan Aruch. Kavod is not so much etiquette and politeness, but it refers to how you perceive another person. Kavod comes from the same shorish as kaved, heaviness, heft, significance, weight, right? We use this even in English. When a person, we might say as a slang phrase, this person is a real heavyweight. We're not referring to Mike Tyson necessarily. But intellectually, when he says something, that's something you pay attention to. There is gravitas, there is significance. So having kavod for another person doesn't just mean be polite with a sense of disdain, but that you see within that person something good, something noble, something worthy. Like Rav Chaim Shulevitz used to say, that the ultimate mitzvah of kibud avim, also kavod, is a person has to identify in their parents qualities that are worthy of emulation and admiration. It's not that, my parents don't do anything for me, but I got to respect them. Rather, the chiyuv. Now, Baruch Hashem, in the vast majority of times, that's not a difficult thing to do. But even if it's difficult, you got to try to do it anyway. That's part of the exercise of kibud avim. So, going back to the theme here of Yira and Shalem, this same contradiction exists during Sfira. I become stronger in my Yiddishkeit. And I become more tolerant and accepting of the spectrum that exists within human beings, to see their good points and to see their strengths and to see the worthiness of their aspirations. But you see, you run into this contradiction all the time. And I don't necessarily have an answer for it other than to say that Yerushalayim says you have to balance the Yira and the Shalom. Tzvi Ras HaOmer says you grow in your Torah and your Yira by also improving the sense of seeing the Kavod in others. This, of course, goes back to the model of Avraham Avinu himself. On one hand, Avraham Avinu was a fanatic. He was the true believer, to use Eric Hoffer's expression. Chazal say he's called Avraham HaYivri, Avraham from the other side of the river, because the whole world could be on one side of the tracks, and Avraham Avinu said, sorry, you're wrong. And yet, that same Avraham Avinu, who was literally a fanatic in his belief in Hashem, was the Avraham Avinu who saw the redemptive potential even in the Anshei Sodom, who prayed for them, who bargained with Hashem for them when he didn't bargain even for his life of his own son, which is another question. So, if one asks the question, is it possible to have both? The answer is it is possible. But it's very, very difficult. And this indeed, as I say, in Yerushalayim we see this struggle day in and day out. It would seem that one of the points that I think all of us should take in mind is a pasuk in Mishlei. Shlomo HaMelech says, "Kemayim haponim elponim, kein leif ha'adam li'adam." As water reflects the face that you show the water, so too the heart of one human being reflects what is shown to it. What does it mean? So the Vilna Gaon says, it's shot in the pasuk, when I look at water, whatever face I show the water is the face I will see back from the water. I smile at the water, I will get a smiling face. I frown at the water, I will get a frowning face. So too, Shlomo HaMelech says, one human being reflects back the vibe, so to speak, they get from another human being. If I look at a person with disparagement, if I look at a person with disdain, if I look at a person that they have nothing to offer, or even worse, they are a Amalek, or whatever language is sometimes used, then they will look at me the same way. If I strive to see the good in a person, see the value in a person, the goodness in a person, even if there are so many things that I disagree with, they will also see the goodness in me. Which is why, in the very, very hotly charged atmosphere of Yerushalayim, so little gets accomplished in terms of the religious secular divide. Because each side absolutely demonizes. I have to say, and I've been in Eretz Yisrael 7 years, and it's still a strange thing, because B'teva, maybe it's an American thing, I don't know, B'teva, somebody has a certain position. So naturally I say, I see your point, but, no such thing. You're totally wrong. You have no point. And I have no point. And that's what happens. And that's where it is, and that's where it stays. And then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. As opposed to, again, this does not mean giving up on your point. You put in your but. But there's a tremendous difference between saying, I hear what you're saying, but, versus what you're saying is evil and no good. Because that just means, that just elicits a reciprocal response. So, people say, yes, but we have to serve Hashem this way. That's the Yira. But it's certainly not the Shalom. One has to find a way to do both. And that really, perhaps, is a central question. No, the Israeli papers every year have lists, people list the top 10 problems that Israeli society faces. And we have a whole list of problems. We have terrorism, we have the threat of nuclear war from Iran, now even North Korea is getting into the act, and the like. There are issues of water, the economy, housing, even the price of cottage cheese made it 1 year. But the number one problem, every single year, and this is across all segments of the population, ranging from Haredi to Dati Leumi to Chazal, again, we divide things in so many, we're such a small country and such a small nation, and we have so many divisions. You know, it is said that the Eskimos have 300 words for different shades of white, because they have to identify all sorts of gradations of snow and ice, because it's very important. I heard that's an urban legend, but be it as it may, this is what the Olam likes to say. So in Eretz Yisrael, because religion is so important, we divide people up in hundreds and hundreds of groups that are not visible to your naked eyes. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But we make all the differences, all the distinctions. Because we want to serve Hashem in the way that we think is the best way, which is Yira. But when the Yira destroys Shalom, the city is not together. Yerushalayim is not Yerushalayim. It is only one and not the other. So this is the theme of Sfira, and this is the theme of Yerushalayim, and this is the big, big challenge. You know, I'll give you another example. I don't want to say too much because, once again, Chas v'shalom, I just say Lashon Hara about the land. Tova Aretz Ma'ot Ma'ot. One has to be very careful not to commit the chet of the Meraglim. But it's just something that, you know, we have obviously the major, major issue in Eretz Yisrael right now is the issue of the army and yeshiva students in the army and what should be done about it. And this is a debate and the like. On one hand, a believer in Hashem understands the vital importance of full-time Torah learning, not just as a religious imperative, but as a contributor to the security of the state of Israel. This is what a Maimon believes. On the other hand, we do need an army. We do need an army. Hashem, you know, does not operate through open miracles. So, as a result, there are demonstrations and protests and the like. And around a year and a half ago, there was a major, major demonstration. It was a peaceful demonstration against the government's plan to abolish the draft exemption, etc. And Baruch Hashem, it was peaceful. It did not involve denigration. But here is a fantasy I had. What would have been if at the end of that demonstration there would have also been a recitation of a prayer for the chayalim who do serve in the army? I'm not a prophet, obviously, but I think a number of things might have happened. One is Mashiach might have come, and that's actually a very distinct possibility. The other thing is, based on Kamayim Apanim El Panim, if we, even people, let's say people who, you know, are in favor of the full-time Torah exemption, I don't want to say we, because I know within the audience itself there are going to be different views. But if those who are in favor of the full-time Torah exemption as a necessity would also appreciate what the other side is doing, then the other side would appreciate it as well. We're all on the same team. We are all contributing to the security of Eretz Yisrael and to the Jewish people. And each side could see the other as a shutef, as a partner. That would change the perceptions all over, as opposed to the notion of one side demonizing the other side, which just results in being demonized by that other side. Now you might say, well, why should I be the one that starts it? Let them like me first, and then I'll like them. The answer is, ultimately, somebody has to be the adult in the room. And if a person is a maimon in Torah and mitzvahs, then you take the first step if you have to take the first step. And when you take the first step, there's going to be a second step. So I think that, you know, if this attitude could be a bit more widespread, I think it would have remarkable results in terms of even getting what Haredim believe that is necessary. It could happen. So let me just end with this idea. And that is, Chazal have a Maimer Chazal, Kolam is Abel al Yerushalayim, Zoche v'raya b'simchasa. Anyone who mourns over Jerusalem will merit and see its joy. Chassam Sofer points out, however, that that is not quite an accurate translation. Because Zoche V'roeh is not future. If it would have said Yiskeh V'yireh, that would be future. Zoche V'roeh means if you're Misabel over Yerushalayim, you are experiencing right now the joy of the redemption of Jerusalem. How is that so? If I'm mourning over the Korban Beis HaMikdash, how is it that I'm Zoche V'roeh B'Simchasa? So here the Chassam Sofer says the following explanation. If you remember when Yosef was sold into slavery, and the brothers went back to Yaakov, they dipped his coat in blood, and they said a wild animal had torn him up. So the Pasuk says Yaakov refused to be comforted. He was not comforted. And Rashi brings from Chazal that although Yaakov didn't know if Yosef was alive or not, but somehow the neshama sensed it. And the concept that time heals all wounds, that eventually we get over losses and tragedies, is only if someone's dead. But if someone's alive, somehow metaphysically, we can't get over the loss. Now, why didn't Yaakov figure out that Yosef must be alive? I don't know. But be it as it may, ein mekablin tanchumin. So, here's what the Chassam Sofer said. The Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed for so many years. If we really believed that redemption was dead, we would get over it. We still wouldn't be mourning. If I still feel the pain of loss, it must be that the idea of redemption is alive, and therefore I'm not mekabel nechamah. And therefore, call him misabel al Yerushalayim. If you are really misabel, that very aveilus is zoche v'roeh. You are experiencing joy in that morning because it's alive to you. It's a reality. You know, in this respect, Jonathan Rosenblum, who's a very, very good columnist for the Jerusalem Post, other magazines, he's actually a Yale law graduate who became a Baal Tshuva after law school, but he did not yet formally renounce his education. sometimes you have to go through that process. They haven't gotten me yet either, but okay, but I may be on the chopping block soon. He tells a very interesting story. He tells a story about a Palestinian terrorist who languished in an Israeli prison for many years until, unfortunately, he was released as part of a prisoner exchange program. Again, that also deserves a talk of its own. And he was interviewed, I think, by Al Jazeera, and he was asked at some point, in all of your years that you languished in prison, and you saw how powerful Israel was, did you ever give up hope in your revolutionary struggle? And he said, there were times that I gave up. There were times that I believed it was hopeless. But what changed it was during Pesach, during the Jewish Passover, he says, I saw one of my Jewish guards eating bread. And I said to the Jewish guard, why are you eating bread? This is your holiday, Pesach. You're eating bread? And the Jew said, what happened 4,000 years ago is of no interest to me. The Palestinian terrorist said, God forbid, but his words were, then I knew we would win because we care about what happened 4,000 years ago, and they don't. Now, Jonathan Rosenblum was making a point that we have to learn even from our enemies, that we have to care about our history. We have to care about what Hashem did for us. The more we care, the more powerful we become, because the more divine siyata dishmaya Hashem will give us. And if we care not only about the past, but we also yearn for the future, and we affirm within our own personalities that Geula is not dead and redemption is not simply over with, then that itself will be a source of joy and delight. And I'll just end with this. The Medrash tells us that why was Moshe Rabbeinu denied burial in Eretz Yisrael? And Yosef was given burial in Eretz Yisrael. Yosef was carried in the desert for 40 years. And the Medrash answers, because when Paro asks Yosef, where are you from? So Yosef says, I am of the Hebrew nation from Eretz Canaan. So Yosef does not deny his land of origin. Therefore, he merits to be buried in his land of origin. Moshe meets the daughters of Yisro. Moshe identifies himself as, I'm from Mitzrayim. He denied his origin. He therefore did not have the merit of being buried in his land of origin. Now the question is very obvious. Moshe, in fact, never was in Eretz Yisrael. If Moshe Rabbeinu was asked, where are you from? And he says, I'm from Mitzrayim. That is not a cover-up. That is not a lie. That is not denying anything. That is the truth. Why is the Medrash suggesting that somehow Moshe Rabbeinu is covering up? And the explanation that's given is that you see that when you're asked, where are you from? What is your home? To what nation or what country do you belong? It makes no difference where you were born or where you lived. A person says, I'm from Eretz Yisrael. That's where I'm connected. No matter where they physically happen to be. They say there was a Hasidic Rebbe in Poland whose family had been in Poland for 500 years. 500 years. And when he was asked, where are you from? He would say, we are Yidden from Yerushalayim who have been in Poland for the past 500 years. It's kind of the way New Yorkers talk, actually. You know, when they're, you know, they should be somewhere for 50 years. You know, I'm from Brooklyn and the like. But when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, that indeed is. And in that way, even if one is not physically living in Eretz Yisrael, as Rav Yehuda Levi said, Libi b'Mizrach, your heart is still to the east. And where your heart is and where your soul is, that is truly where you're located. So Be'ezus Hashem, we should be Zocha to celebrate the 50th unification of Yerushalayim, but from that point it should lead to the Geula Shleima b'Meheirah v'Yameinu.